The National Broadcasting Company brings you a report from Europe. From our NBC staff covering the Council of Foreign Ministers, each Saturday at this time we call in our correspondents overseas for a special report on developments abroad. Now to London and Merrill Muller, Leon Pearson.
The Council of Foreign Ministers avoided what might have been another acrimonious session this afternoon by postponing its meeting until Monday of next week. The postponement, which is explained as a convenience for study of relative positions after 3 weeks' debate, was officially announced about 2 hours before Molotov, Beto, Bevan, and Marshall were to meet at Lancaster House today. Actually, however, the postponement, to which all four agreed, resulted from the combination of Foreign Minister Beto's desire to cool tempers and Ernest Bevan's need for a weekend of rest and study. Mr. Bevan and Secretary of State Marshall yesterday evening thought a postponement might serve a useful purpose, but neither one of them wished to be responsible for suggesting it in the fear that Molotov might misconstrue it. Bevan, who presides at the next session, therefore used his prerogative as chairman to telephone the Secretariat of the Council this morning and ask them to determine if a postponement would be convenient to the other ministers, including Mr. Marshall. It was at this point that Monsieur Beto's idea of cooling tempers intervened, so that he became the compromise agent by which the Secretariat arranged the postponement. Mr. Marshall, meanwhile, went ahead with the morning meeting of his American delegation. At this meeting, Mr. Marshall instructed his advisers to prepare a complete answer to Molotov's charges of American financial exploitation of Western Germany. He wanted these facts in a document to be tabled immediately and left for permanent reference of the Soviet delegation. The facts, of course, showing the actual American losses in subsidizing Germany and thus putting the lie to Molotov's charges of profiteering. This paper was completed and rushed to Lancaster House this afternoon. After this conference, Mr. Marshall hastened to Ambassador Douglas' residence at Princess Gate to welcome Molotov and his key advisors to a private luncheon. We are told that this luncheon was a strictly social affair in a friendly enough atmosphere and without any reference to the problems in hand, which leaves the Council of Foreign Ministers and the world just where it was last night, in a critical stalemate on international affairs with serious and possibly tragic consequences either way. Both the American and British delegations believe that these are the closing days of this meeting, although the optimists of both teams point out that Molotov has left a way open by which he can continue the conference on procedure and get back to reparations again later. It's doubtful if he will take this line, however, unless, as today's London Star says in an exclusive story, he talked to Moscow by telephone last night for new instruction. He is believed by some well-informed diplomats to already hold the power to table a new document with definite concessions of substance. But that is exactly what he must do if this conference and future peace is to be saved. Now, with the background to the CFM, here is Leon Pearson.
Three American newspapermen were talking about this conference of foreign ministers here in London. Each described it in his own figure of speech. One said it was like a magician's act. Now you see it and now you don't. The second said it was like a whale. There's more to it than appears on the surface. And the third said it was like a billiard ball spinning backward as it moves ahead. Each in his own way was saying the same thing, that this conference has a deceptive or tricky quality which makes it difficult to follow, and that's the truth. And that's what makes it so fateful and so fascinating. I've covered most of the meetings of the CFM here in London, in Paris, and in Moscow, but I've never known a conference in which there was so much reverse English. That makes it harder to know what's really happening, but much more intriguing. Why is it? Why do we get so much shadow and so little substance? The reason is that the two great powers who are the titans today are so divided by antagonism and suspicion that they cannot trust one another to agree on anything. The work they came here to do was to make a peace treaty for Germany. But while they give one ear to the speeches at the council table, they hear in the other mutual declarations of economic warfare. The Russians regard the Marshall Plan as economic warfare against them in Europe, despite the fact that they were invited to come in. The Americans regard the Soviet determination to obstruct the Marshall Plan as meaning they will do everything possible to prevent the recovery of Germany. And since the unification of Germany would merely open up the Western zones to that obstructive effort, it follows that Mr. Marshall is not very keen about unification. In short, you can't make peace at the council table while, on the other side of the channel, a great battle is being waged between the very powers seated in the council. There's a feeling of distrust which makes agreement impossible. It's felt by the American delegation, by the British, and even the French. Monsieur Beto said to one of his advisers the other day, when the communist strikes were raging in France, "Here I am talking amicably with Mr. Molotov while Zhdanov is making war on my country." So whatever the big four discussion, is on a given day, whether movement of goods in Germany or methods of consulting with other powers on the peace treaty, never mind what, they are looking with suspicion at one another. As one of the Americans said, speaking of the Soviets, their ulterior purposes are more weighty than their evident purposes. At the same time, and this is good news, the split between us and the Russians has been accompanied by a closer union and understanding between us and the French. For the past 2 years, Mr. Bideau has been sitting on the fence, fearful of coming down on our side lest he offend the Communist Party in France. But now the breach is made in France. The Schuman government is the declared foe of the Communists, and the French foreign minister can safely come down on the western side of the fence as he has long wanted to do. This means that in the post-conference agreements, it will be much easier to do business with the French. There's that question of fusion with the French zone and the Anglo-American zone, the international control of the Ruhr without the Russians. Here's an issue on which Bideau thinks that Molotov may try to split the Western delegations in the last days of the conference by making the French declare their traditional policy on the Ruhr, which includes detachment from Germany, while the British and Americans are opposed to detachment. But I can reveal that Bideau has already told Bevin and Marshall, "Don't worry, gentlemen. Though I may be forced to restate our traditional position, I am ready to go along with you if we can agree on details. At any rate, let us not be driven apart by Mr. Molotov." But what will be the final result of the conference? Here is my own forecast in 4 points. First, the conference will reach no agreement on any major issue. Second, it will adjourn in a few days without fixing a time for another meeting. Third, the Big Three will then hold separate talks on fusion of the western zones of Germany. Finally, the Big Three will avoid an overt partitioning, will not abandon Berlin, but will proceed with the economic and political reconstruction of Western Germany. But there's another story in London, and here is Merrill Muller to open it.
A Scotland Yard dragnet for whiskey and food racketeers around London last night and today reminds one that these final shopping days before Christmas have created a fantastic but altogether colorless buying spree in Britain. The Christmas rush is on, and retail traders are reporting an all-time high in sales, by value, not volume, for goods are either rationed or in short supply. Inflationary prices are more than covering the losses of empty shelves, and Board of Trade experts predict that this Christmas rush will boost retail trade for the month to over 175% of that of 1938, by value again, and more than 10% higher than Christmas last year. If the scene is drab, the spirit at least is gay. There is more abandon to the idea of Christmas this year than there was last, although the austerity life, if anything, is even more Spartan. There is also more money about, as was expected, with the result that the demand for goods is pushing black market prices to ridiculous heights, although it is to the credit of responsible shop traders that they are carefully siphoning off their Christmas stocks to meet the rush and try to hold prices in line. The keynote of this Christmas spirit came from the royal family and a gesture of good neighborliness today. The reigning queen set the pattern by driving into Windsor this afternoon for some public shopping, and perhaps unknowingly also set the style by picking her presents only from the carriage trade shops. And Norway this afternoon notified Britain that London's Trafalgar Square, heart of the empire, shall have a gift of a huge 45-foot Christmas tree. The London County Council immediately made plans to decorate that tree in the best pre-war custom and give London a splash of color the likes of which she hasn't seen since the Nazi fire blitz of Christmas Eve 1940. The shortages of whiskey and fowl have been accentuated, of course, by this rush, with the result that whiskey has now skyrocketed to $20 a bottle and turkeys to almost $2 per pound. Cigarette supplies also suddenly dried up, even at the free market price of 68 cents per package. Most gifts, of course, are practically beyond the reach of the ordinary laborer's wage packet. So the smart buyer does his shopping in the second-hand stores, where he not only finds bargains but escapes all purchase taxes, which range from 30 to 125%. The middle classes, and what's left of Millionaire's Row, seem to have been selling off their better stock holdings in recent weeks to meet the price tags of limited supplies of better quality gifts. This trend has been particularly noticeable in dealings of the railroad shares, which will be nationalized on the 1st of January in any case, and in the losses of the government savings bond campaign. Very few stores are offering Christmas wrappings or gay decorations, although one store surrounded its entire one-block frame with gaily trimmed Christmas trees. The paper shortage accounts for the continued drabness, and when I tell you that a string of 8 lights for a Christmas tree costs $20, you will understand the absence of any glow of color. However, it is not preventing the people from queuing up and jostling their strained and shabby fellows at every shopping counter. Gaiety is the keynote. Every London play, every hotel, every nightclub is solidly booked for Christmas week. The people apparently feel that what their inflated money will not buy in goods, it will buy in pleasure. Christmas away from home is definitely a pattern this year. Those well off who jam into London are being copied by the lower classes who have reserved every last vestige of space in every resort town along the Channel coast, particularly out in the Southwest, where rumor has it the food's supposed to be better and sometimes the sun shines. Away from home, or at home at any price, with Christmas rations improved and good cheer, the British people mean to have a Merry Christmas. And Merry Christmas it will be in the old British spirit. But now, for Impressions of London, here again is Leon Pearson.
I have returned to London after an absence of nearly 2 years, and I'm getting a series of fresh impressions about this city of Englishmen. Here in rapid succession are the things I see. The strain of enduring shortages and restrictions after the war is almost too much to bear. Here and there, black market operations. If you haven't got clothing coupons, you can buy them for a price. But it's not like France, where the black market rules everything. No, the British are still law-abiding. Here is a Cockney selling newspapers and telling me between sales, "We English haven't forgot our manners, not yet." Doctors are overwhelmed with demands for special permits. A woman wants an elastic stocking or a baby carriage for twins or a hot water bottle or foreign currency for an overseas vacation. She goes to the doctor for a special certificate. At Hyde Park Corner, where free speech is very free indeed, a man stands on a soapbox and harangues his unwashed audience. "Who's making you pay a penny more for your beer and tuppence more for your baccy? It's them Americans, that's who. The American bankers from Wall Street. They're getting all the profits all the way round the world. It's imperialism, that's what it is." A chambermaid in a West End hotel, fashionable West End hotel, still reflecting romantically on the royal wedding, says, "Wasn't that a crowd? Wasn't that something? It just makes you feel good to know, what with this Labour government and all, that we haven't gone bolshy, not yet." The British papers are suffering a shortage of newsprint, and yet one of the evening papers today devotes a whole page, or one-fourth of its total space, to the schedules for the dog races. There is not a first-class evening paper in all London. Wool and cotton cloth are in such shortage that the Ministry of Supply is having a hard time to find that free suit of clothes called a demob suit, which is given to soldiers on demobilization. 300,000 more men will be demobilized by next June. Not only is gasoline rationed, but the basic gas ration has been withdrawn, which means no pleasure driving. Today, a certain member of Parliament is very uncomfortable because he was observed and reported to the police when he drove his car to the golf club on his way home. Taxis are cheap. You can ride across the heart of London for 3 shillings, that's 60 cents. But luxuries are very dear. Cigarettes, $6.80 a carton. Scotch whiskey, $20 a bottle. And one good Havana cigar, $5. Britain has a socialist government, but the basic tenets of individualism are still present in the British character. At Claridge's Hotel, the resort of visiting royalty, there was a strike at the time of the royal wedding. Outside the hotel, pickets walked up and down all day, all night, with placards reading, "Don't patronize this hotel. Don't be a blackleg." A blackleg is a scab. But who were on strike? The kitchen help? Oh, no. Yes, the kitchen help, but not those pillars of class distinction who wear the uniforms and deal with the guests upstairs. No, they scorned their fellow workers and stayed on the job until the strike was broken. They seemed to say, in every dignified move they made, there'll always be an England. This is Leon Pearson signing off for Merrill Muller and myself in London.
Each Saturday at 1:45, NBC presents a report from Europe by its staff of reporters overseas. From London today, we've heard Merrill Muller and Leon Pearson. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.